Here in the South, the elders tell us certain stories as absolute truths, never to be questioned, about history, about religion, and about the two mixed together. And stories like that can feel like big, heavy rocks in our pockets. They are, after all, set in stone. And some Southerners are happy to leave those ideas unquestioned, others are not. And I've always been one of the second kind. For some people, the questioning turns life inside out, sending them into long ordeals of searching, finding, losing, and regaining. One such person is a man from South Alabama named Abe Partridge, whose art I discovered almost 10 years ago and who I now have the good fortune to call my friend. His music has taken him on tours across America and Europe. He hosted a hit podcast called Alabama Astronaut, and he is a painter whose work has hung in galleries and museums. But Abe's life as an artist came together only after questioning those absolutes turned his whole world upside down, along with the lives of his wife, Kathy, and their children. I discovered Abe's music in 2018. In 2022, Tad Bartlett, an Alabama-born writer whose work often appears in my magazine, Salvation South, became fascinated with Abe's podcast and asked to write a story about him called The Book of Abraham, and we published it a few years ago. But I didn't want Salvation South to tell Abe's story on the page and be done with it. I wanted to sit with him and talk about what it means in the South to have your life rearranged by questioning things you were told should never be questioned. And I knew I didn't want to have that conversation with Abe alone. Tad Bartlett and I have also wrestled with faith and with the history of this region in our own ways, and I suspected that if the three of us sat down together, we might get closer to understanding what happens when those so-called absolutes start to crack. And that is the conversation you're about to hear. And we did not start it with an agenda, just two simple questions. What did we learn as young men that we no longer believe? And what did we not learn that we now do believe? I'll let you hear the beginning of our answers. This is Abe Partridge.
You know, I thought that my group was the best group, you know. There was nothing, nothing outside. Everything outside of my group had to be judged in comparison to mine. And I no longer believe that. I probably wouldn't have said it like this, but certainly it was there in my head, was that everybody in the world should believe just like me. And, I think it's a feature in probably a lot of different, you know, Southern fundamentalist types of environments.
Here is Tad Bartlett.
I was not born in Alabama, born in the South. We moved there when I was five. And I grew up thinking it was not the best place to be from. People asked me, where are you from? I would never just say Alabama or the South. I would go through the whole litany of I was born overseas, my dad was in the service, and we moved to Missouri, and when I was five, we moved to Alabama, but I would never admit to being from there. I no longer believe that it is just inherently and automatically a bad thing to confess being from and of the South.
And here I am.
As for me, I grew up believing that when I saw that Confederate battle flag, rebel flag, I thought it was a symbol of nothing more than just rebellion. You know, I was a kid in the 70s when Southern rock was a big thing, and it wasn't uncommon to see, you know, a rebel flag on stage. And the first band I ever saw was the Charlie Daniels Band when The South's Gonna Do It Again was a hit. Be proud, you were rebel.
I no longer believe the South is going to do it again, or even should, at least not in the way old Charlie Daniels meant it. Today on Salvation South Deluxe, you will hear a conversation about how some Southern stories, once set in stone, can crumble and leave holes in your life, and how the three of us have tried, in our own ways, to fill them. I'm Chuck Reese, and welcome to Salvation South Deluxe, a series of in-depth pieces we add to our regular podcast feed. On what we like to call Deluxe, we try to unravel the tangled stories that make up the history of a very complicated place, the American South.
On a revival hill, a sinner's delight, as I begged my heart to steal. And I walked out into the night on a teenage thrill. I never meant to close my eyes till your light grew dim. And now, Lord, I ain't asking for a brand new start. I just need your direction on finding love in the dark.
That is the title song of Abe Partridge's 2022 album, Love in the Dark. And you just heard the first verse and chorus. Now, it might have sounded to you like a song about a teenager who finds a person who lights him up and then loses that person. And that would make sense. Abe, after all, was born in 1980, had a rather stormy childhood, and grew up loving rock and roll. So that would be one way to hear the song. The other is as a song about a teenager who finds the stability that he seeks in God. Because Abe didn't start his adult life as a musician, a podcaster, or an artist. He started as a young, fiery preacher.
I grew up loving rock and roll. And I mean, the first band I ever heard that I loved was Nirvana. You know, which just led me down a long path. And then so I was just a rock and roll kid until I was 18. And I had my mother and father split up when I was young, and had a kind of a lot of, you know, tumultuous a childhood. And I was looking for some stability. And when I was 18, I had a religious experience, and then went into a very similar kind of, you know, very black and white version of Christianity.
Abe and I have talked over the years about how I grew up in a version of Christianity that was quite black and white, like the one he found himself drawn to when he was 18. Now, in churches like the ones I grew up in, there was often one answer to why we believed what we believed: so you won't go to hell.
The theology that I adopted was rigid, you know, from the question of who is God all the way to what kind of clothes do I wear, and you know what was that? There was an answer for every question, and it was very much you know, a holiness or hell, repent or perish type of Christianity.
What was the religious experience that got you into that?
Well, within the church, they would call it a conversion experience. I was going to these, I had been going to these independent fundamental Baptist churches, and I had been listening to the preaching. And, you know, at the time, what I would have referred to it as was conviction of the Holy Ghost. And in retrospect, the way I look at it is as I was a kid longing for something to base my life upon that felt solid because I was directionless.
Abe joined the small, independent, fundamental Baptist church where he had that experience. And that was in 1998. He was 18 years old.
Old-time religion, old-time religion is good enough for me.
Abe then decided to attend Bible college with the goal of becoming a preacher. Now, he flunked out of three such institutions before he finally earned his degree. And in 2001, he met his now wife, Kathy, a fellow student who had been raised fundamentalist.
Me and my wife, Kathy, got married the very day after I graduated from the fourth Bible college.
Ultimately, in 2006, Kathy and Abe wound up in Middlesboro, Kentucky, a town in the Cumberland Gap where Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia all come together. And to understand the revelation that took Abe to Middlesboro, you need to understand the lay of the land there.
And now Middlesboro is built in a bowl. It's a meteorite crater. A meteor came down, boom, pulled out a big bowl in the middle of the Appalachians.
Right.
You can stand in the middle of Middlesboro and do a 360. And
you're surrounded by a ridge. Yeah.
And every time it rains there, it floods.
In the world of tiny, independent, fundamental Baptist churches in the South, a potential pastor is not hired by interviewing with a church committee. Instead, you get invited to preach in the church, and then they decide if they want you as their pastor. Abe first went to Middlesboro after he got such an invitation.
So I went up to Middlesboro and preached for them, and then they were like, yeah, this is the guy we want.
It was a small congregation, no more than 50 or 60 members.
You know, then it was up to me if I wanted to do it or not, so, which meant, you know, uprooting my family. I had two children at that time. So I prayed about this for a couple of weeks, and one day I came in, and I had a Bible, and I set it out on my lap, and it opened Deuteronomy chapter 11, which it's not really where you go in the Bible if you're looking for direction, right?
In the 11th chapter of the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy, in the King James Version, which was the one Abe was reading, you will find this scripture in verses 10 and 11. The land, whither thou goest in to possess it, is not as the land of Egypt, from which ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed, and waterest it with thy foot, as a garden of herbs. But the land, whither ye go to possess it, is a land of hills and valleys, and drinketh water of the rain of heaven.
And it was that Bible right up there, actually, that black one. It fell open, and in the first place my eyes landed, and this is the only time that this has ever happened to me in my whole life, and it's spooky as hell, and I don't even know what to say about it other than I can promise you that it happened. But I looked down at my Bible, and it said, the land whither ye shall go to possess it is a land of hills and of valleys, and it drinketh of the waters of the rains of heaven. And so when I read that, I was like, that's it. So I was going to possess those hills and valleys. So I left, and I told him I'd take the church. And so me and Kathy moved up there.
But when he became pastor of that Kentucky church, his faith, suddenly and unexpectedly, no longer felt so solid.
After graduating, I was always in these really insular communities. I was inside them. And all of my friends, the people I talked to, the people that I spent time with, they were all independent fundamental Baptists.
To go to Middlesboro, he left that sheltered environment.
I was no longer inside that insular community. I was now the head of a church. So that gave me the space to begin doing my own introspection or examination of who I was and what I believed. Because up until that point, I was trying to be what the man up on the podium with the Bible was. And I was trying to believe what they said to believe. It seemed really stable. That was the one thing about, you know, the gospel is it's unchanged. You know, it never changed. You know, it's like this, it's like the story that goes back a couple thousand years, you know? So it was like, this is what I'm going to build my life upon. And it makes sense to me now coming from, you know, the childhood I had, but yeah, it was removing myself out of that community that allowed myself to figure out, like, I wasn't convicted of a lot of these things myself. I was carrying something else that somebody else told me to carry.
In Middlesboro, he encountered people and situations that Bible college never taught him to anticipate.
My first Sunday there, my Sunday school teacher, she comes in with Minnie Mouse pajamas and slippers on. And I'm like, what are you doing? If you're going to be teaching kids, you're going to have to, you know, not right. Wear Minnie Mouse pajamas.
That one declaration about a pair of Minnie Mouse pajamas split that little church in two.
About 30 of them gone. And then I was like, oh my God, what have I done? You know?
Seemed like a, you know.
Seems very reasonable,
enough,
right?
Reasonable enough.
Seemed yeah. Reasonable. Even now it still seems reasonable to me. I didn't say you couldn't come.
Right.
I said, you come however you want to, but if you're going to lead these kids, they're in the morning.
Later, after he'd built the membership back up to around 60 again, he ran into another situation, this time with his song leader, a situation that was a lot more than just challenging.
He had been my song leader for about 6 months, 7, 8 months, something like that. And I seen him sitting in the back row by his blood brother's daughter, his niece.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit by each other and then they put their arm around each other and then I'm like, nah, surely not. And then I look outside the window one day and they're kissing each other in the mouth in the parking lot. And I'm like, hey, dude, y'all ain't, this ain't happening, right? And he's like, well, we love each other and we're moving in and yeah, we're, you know. He's like, you can't tell me what's right and wrong. And I'm like, buddy, look, I ain't trying to tell you what's right and wrong. I'm just telling you that's incest, and you can't be leading songs here living in an incestuous relationship.
And calling out that relationship split the church again.
And after that split, it created a despair, I guess you could say. And I tried my best to find strength.
But within the rigid theology of such churches, ministers having doubts, well, that's not really a thing.
You know, a preacher can't say, hey, I need help, you know. like, hey, I'm having doubts, you know. I mean, you know. All the preachers are like, I know that 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 I know, you know, and then when I'm sitting over here listening like, man, I wish I did, you know.
When the church crumbled, Abe felt abandoned. Later this year, Salvation South will publish an essay Abe has written about his experiences in the church. And I want to read you here a small portion of it. I have a vivid memory of the day I left the church. When I got through the Cumberland Gap, out of the crater, I looked in the rearview mirror to see it all behind me. I felt like I was breaking out of prison. The Independent Baptists call me an apostate. I didn't know what I was. I just knew that I had to stay alive for my wife and kids, and the ministry would have killed me. Then began my dark years.
Well, there's little pieces of me that have died over time, and I find them in things I left behind.
After this break, we'll be back to talk about how Abe got through those dark years and what he found to fill the holes those broken stories left behind. As Abe and Kathy Partridge drove their kids out of Middlesboro, they felt less like they had abandoned the church and more like the church had abandoned them. What followed were the dark years.
I was miserable for so long. I was miserable until I was about 35, 36 years old. From about 26 or so to about 30. 35, 36, I was absolutely miserable. And any thoughts about my youth, I mean, I would sweat thinking about how I wasted my youth.
He carried that weight along with the pressure of supporting his family. So he joined the U.S. Air Force and served 3.5 years on active duty. He is still a reservist.
It was my attempt to figure out a way to provide for my family financially. I joined the military to try to escape poverty. And it worked. I've never been as poor as I was before I joined the military after.
Here I want to return to Abe's essay. I'm quoting from it here. Kathy and I, along with our two children, moved in with my mother in Alabama. I joined the service in a last-ditch effort at finding some kind of respectable way to provide for my family. Basic training and Air Force Technical School made me a military man. Deployments hardened me. Military life was desensitizing, leaving me calloused toward anything of a spiritual nature. My prayers went from shouts on the mountains to mumbles in the valley. I was constantly trying to reinvent myself. I attempted to buy into the military role to no avail. I went into the reserves and tried to go blue collar. Nothing ever suited me. Outside of the church, I could not find an identity. So I carried a deep, debilitating regret, the kind of regret that occasionally caused me to break out into cold sweats and dry heaves. The weight of a squandered youth was more than I could carry. It would settle down upon me at random times and leave me crippled. I was a haunted man. In the book of Matthew, as Jesus is winding down his Sermon on the Mount, this is what he says. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house and it fell. And great was its fall. Abe thought he had stood on the rock, but it turned into sand. I want to return now to his writing here, quoting again from his essay. I poured my agony into rhyme and color. My only solace from the torment was to write songs and to paint. I sang my songs to the walls of my bedroom. I made paintings that I hid away in a closet. My art was my refuge. Years passed. Writing and painting gave Abe a small refuge from his misery, but it did not turn on a light inside him the way his experience in church had when he was a teenager. Here is another passage from his essay. I went to war. I spent Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's Day, and my 34th birthday participating in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. War was monotonous. I worked 6 12-hour shifts a week, getting into a sick rhythm. Days passed like hours. I became completely lost in the routine, almost hypnotized. Then, one evening, during a lull in the tempo of our mission, I snapped out of it. I looked out into the red Arabian skies, wondering just how I ended up here. I recounted my years in the ministry. I carefully examined my failure in Middlesbrough and the ensuing series of decisions that led to that desert. A softness found its way back into my heart. I wept. My weeping became my prayer. I had no words to offer God, but He accepted my tears. It was the beginning of a reckoning. Time begat healing. In the desert, the certainty of Abe's old faith was gone. But something else began to speak, a quieter kind of prayer, one that arose from songs and paintings. Abe was not, in those years, willing to let anyone else hear his songs or see his paintings. But then, as many of us do in these modern times, he got some help from YouTube.
And I discovered YouTube, you know, back before YouTube had ads every 5 minutes.
Right.
And I was looking, I loved this banjo player named Roscoe Holcomb. Black officer just sitting in the corner, she ain't a pretty girl on the head. I was watching videos of Roscoe Holcomb, and then one day while I was watching videos of Roscoe Holcomb, I saw this young Bob Dylan, you know, which I knew my dad had liked Bob Dylan, but I really didn't hear it. And then I saw him at the Newport Folk Festival. I think it was like 63 or 64 or something before the whole electric thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know.
And he's this young kid.
He's just a kid, yeah. So then I'm like, man, I got to find out all I can about this.
One time ago, a crazy dream came to me. I dreamt I was walking in World War III. I went to the doctor the very next day to see what kind of words you had to say. He said it was a bad dream.
Let's go back to Abe's essay now. I'll read a bit more for you. I did not know if I was abandoned by God or if something in me was broken. In my mind at that time, it could have possibly been both. Then a clip of a young Bob Dylan singing Blowin' in the Wind ignited in my heart like a fire from heaven.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
It was the same kind of fire I felt in those transcendental mountain prayers. The truth in meter and melody pricked my heart. What I had lost in the church, I found in song. I would have been ostracized from my church, so I began to write songs. It was a way for me to express things I could not in conventional ways. When I could not find the words, I would paint it. I filled the basement with banjos, guitars, Walmart, acrylics, scraps of paper and cheap canvases. I had not felt God in years, but I felt something way down in my soul when I wrote a song or created a painting. Making art in my basement filled me with that same joy I used to get from wandering the mountains in prayer. A piece of me died in Middlesbrough, and another piece was born.
Why did you pick up that paintbrush and paint, you know?
Yeah.
Why did you start writing songs? And as you said, I mean,
I had to.
You had to. You've got something you've got to express, and no other way to express it.
If I didn't write or paint, I would be miserable. Much less, just take the money and the finances out of it all. If I won the lottery today, which I don't play, but if I did, I would still wake up in the morning and I would write and I would paint.
It's breathing.
I would tell story. It is. It's what I like to do with my life. It's what I've chosen to do with my life. It's the only thing that I know that provides for me the sense of purpose and meaning that makes life livable.
And I said, baby, they sung you all alone. The devil can't get you if I go, if I go.
Abe eventually went back to Middleboro, but not to his old church. Instead, he went to churches where the congregants take a certain verse from the Gospel of Mark very, very literally. That verse is, "They will pick up snakes in their hands, and if they drink any deadly thing, it will not hurt them." But Abe did not go there to pick up serpents or to revisit the doctrine that had abandoned him. Abe went there for the music.
Well, I'm wrapped up, tied up, tangled up in Jesus. I'm wrapped up, tied up, tangled up in Jesus. I'm wrapped up, tied up, tangled up in Jesus. I'm wrapped up, tied up, tangled in God's word.
You're sitting in a church that's half the size of this house, and you got the most impassioned, intense rock and roll that you've ever heard in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Far beyond anything that you've never experienced music this way. And it's communal. And every single person in that room is participating in some way.
Right.
Whether it's rhythmically, whether they're singing, whether they're stomping their foot, whether they're playing a guitar, everybody's participating. And you're in the middle of nowhere. You're with people that have been essentially thrown away. They literally have no voice. Nobody takes them seriously.
Right.
And they're having this transcendent, hair-raising experience. And you're there, and you're witnessing this.
The pursuit of that music was the genesis of the 2022 podcast series called Alabama Astronaut. Abe and producer Farrell Gibbs visited serpent-handling holiness churches across Appalachia to record powerful, often undocumented worship songs and the people who made them, a community of people who, like Abe, had been thrown away by the mainstream.
Then come out the flames, and then come out these snakes on top of this, and it's mind-blowing, you know. I mean, the night he was there, they were drinking strychnine out of a mason jar, and I look over at him, and then they get down, and then this guy's preaching not about getting rich or going to heaven. He's preaching about sacrifice. And I will never forget that this particular night was probably some of the greatest preaching I've ever heard in my life. Because it was all about death to self. You know, presenting your body a living sacrifice. This is a verse out of the book of Romans, holy and acceptable unto God. And it's not something that really you're going to turn on. They're not going to talk about on the place that wants your money.
Right. You know, we're sitting here, starting to have the more theological parts of our discussion when he says, sort of stops the conversation and switches gears and says, have you ever been to a punk rock show and wanted to jump around? Like, that's his, all of a sudden, just his question. So he was very much putting punk and a punk show in the context of a religious discussion And of course, my answer to him was, well, yeah, I've been to plenty of punk shows and I have jumped around. And he's like, why'd you do that? I said, I felt compelled to. And then he went from that back into the serpent handling service. And, you know, that idea of what you just feel naturally compelled to do and what you feel moved to, I think is the better word.
When I was young, no one in my church took up serpents, but they did stand up and rejoice as if taken over by a Holy Spirit. We did sing loud and long and strong. But in my 20s, after I had left behind the heaven or hell binary choice doctrine of that church, I often found great comfort and courage in the mosh pits and sing-alongs of punk rock shows.
Is there something I said when I lost my mind? My temper too makes me blind. I apologize.
Transcendence comes when we rise above what holds our spirits down. And I have often found it in rooms filled with people that the respectable South might call wrong or backward. In churches and punk clubs alike, I have been blessed to be surrounded by people who were reaching for God with everything they had. And so have my friends Tad and Abe.
Pass me not, O gentle Savior. Hear my humble cry.
Today, Tad and I are less likely to be found in the music clubs than we used to be. Abe, of course, as a touring musician, is in them all the time. But even though our faiths have been used in ways that we think are wrong and led us to rough patches we'd rather have avoided, none of us has left faith behind.
You don't say to people that you've abandoned faith, right, Abe?
No, I've not abandoned faith. In fact, I think it's matured.
See, that's kind of the way I feel about my own journey. I think the question for me now is, how do you bring light and love and grace into these really difficult, divisive situations?
Yeah, you know, my coming up, Chuck, faith-wise, I think you're right. We match each other a lot. You know, except not exactly precise fit, right? I came up in the faith you're in now, I came up Episcopalian. But it's just in Selma, that was a very proper church to be in, is where all the proper people were. And nothing they said was striking me as particularly off, but nothing that they said really grabbed me either. And I grew up into, you know, a teenage punk rocker, and all I had were questions, and I didn't like the answers that they were giving me. And so, I then when I graduated, I went to college at Spring Hill College, a Jesuit school down in Mobile, which is where I imagine Abe, you and I were probably riding by each other in our cars at some point, and you know, me a little bit older than you, and I just didn't even know it. But I brought my questions and my punk rock sensibility to sitting down with the priests there at Spring Hill and the Jesuits and just challenging them. And they were just like, yeah, bring it, bring your questions. And I remember one of them talking about, I think it was St. Augustine, or it could have been Athanasius, one of the desert monks, talking about the church as a community of pilgrims searching, not a community of people latching on to a specific answer. And so that's what I've taken forward with me. And like, how do we find light in everyone? How do we find grace in everyone? By admitting that we all have questions and maybe none of us have the right answer to impose on anyone, right?
I love that idea. Bring your questions. That's what I was describing, you know, that happened to me, you know, when I decided to start attending church again. because I discovered that I'd gone into a place where my questions were welcome.
Well, I'll say, I think what Tad said is beautiful in that he's, you know, referring to, just the idea I had this interview the other day. Somebody was asking me, they said, he said, when I was a kid, I knew God, but then as I got older, I began to wonder about all that. And I said back to him, I said, it sounds like you've been on a journey of honesty, because you didn't know, you thought you knew. We're talking about God. You know, if God's small enough to fit into your five senses and whatever brain matter you got in between your ears, that's a really little God, isn't it?
Yeah. Right.
So it seems like to me that if we're going to be honest with each other, you know, faith is not knowing. You know, in fact, maybe faith is the opposite of knowing, because maybe faith has more to do with honesty.
Faith is not knowing, right? Just to put the emphasis in different places on your sentence there.
But the most difficult thing, I think, is for some people. I mean, if you say faith is not knowing, therefore faith is something that you believe in, even though you don't know it. The problem, I think, becomes a lot of people get to that juncture and they feel like they have to have a strict definition of what to believe in.
Well, that's easy. That's easy, right, Chuck? I mean, if you wrote me out 5 points and said, believe this, that's much easier than me coming up with those 5 points all on my own through living in the world.
For me, I think these days I believe in the value of not knowing. And I'm willing to just let the mystery be. I mean, for me, I find peace in that.
I'm writing a song right now, Chuck, and I got a verse, and I just wrote this like a few days ago, but it's somewhere, it's something like, when I whispered my prayers and no one could hear it, God was a mystery and I was led by the Spirit. So I went to the temple to proclaim and to cheer it. And now I'm stuck in a ritual and learning to fear it.
I think you need to hold on to that one. I'm an inveterate editor, Abe, and I can't find a word I would change in that.
Well, it's kind of saying what you said. I think whenever there's great joy, and I mean, really, to me, the hardest thing a man can do in this world is to look in the mirror and find a way to be happy with what you see, and find a way to be okay with what you see. And that particular point in my life was part of all of that journey. You know, it's like just complete honesty. I don't know, but there's a mystery there. And that's what gives me joy of living. You know,
me too. But you know, then the question becomes, what if you look over your fence into the face of your neighbor and you don't like what you see? What do you do then?
Yeah, it's a difference, I think, between looking across the fence and seeing your neighbor and not liking what you see, and looking across the fence and opening up your ears instead of just your eyes to listen and try to see if you can hear the humanity, there's some common nugget of experience of being human, accepting that you're not going to have the same answers for things, accepting that they may say something and believe that the answer to things is something completely and totally repugnant to you. And the trick there is to still listen to find that nugget of common humanity. And what's the value of that? You know, I go back and forth between, I mean, wildly back and forth between, what's the value to that? You know, if they're believing repugnant things, then they need to be called out. They don't deserve the grace of being seen as human. And then swinging back to, whoa, that's the spiral that we are all caught in as a society in the South, in this nation, in this world, this spiral of denying each other's humanity just because of the repugnance of the things that come out of our mouths.
Yeah, I think we need to learn to talk to each other and not at each other. You know what I mean? There's I think social media and the way that the algorithms and all do, we've learned to talk about things amongst people that believe the same thing that we do, but we've not learned how to talk to things, talk to people that don't believe the things that we do about things. That's just the nature of like where conversation has gone, you know? And me spending time in the serpent handling community has taught me how to talk about things with people that do not share, that I do not share, you know, fundamental beliefs with. And that's just by focusing on the things that we do share and starting conversations starting conversations based on shared beliefs as opposed to things that we have in contrary. And then as you talk about those things that you share, and then bonds of trust and are established, well, then I think you can talk about areas where you may disagree. But like just pointing at people and saying, you know, what you believe is stupid or what you believe is not right, or like, I just don't feel like there's anything constructive that ever comes from that.
When we sat down to have this conversation, we started by asking what we no longer believe and what we've come to believe instead. And I think all three of us simply want to step out of this spiral of denying the humanity of our brothers and sisters and into what Tad calls a community of pilgrims searching together. Folks who are willing to live with the mystery and who want to talk to each other instead of at each other. We all could use a little more of that these days, don't you think? Thank you to my friends Tad Bartlett and Abe Partridge for their help and cooperation in producing this episode. Thank you also to Kathy Partridge for allowing Tad and me to take up so much of Abe's time. And I encourage you to visit abepartridge.com. You can always go there to get a look at his tour schedule and to buy tickets and hear him play his songs live as he travels the world. If you're listening to this episode between when it was released in the middle of February of 2026 and May, you should know that from early March through late May, an exhibition of Abe's paintings called With Signs Following will be hanging at the Kentuck Arts Center at Queen City. That's in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, at 1901 Jack Warner Parkway. You've been listening to Salvation South Deluxe, proudly produced in cooperation with Georgia Public Broadcasting and its network of 20 stations around our state. Once a week on those stations, you can hear 3 minutes of me talking about Southern stuff, and we add every one of those commentaries to our podcast feed. And then every month or so, we add longer deluxe stories, such as the one we just told you. I'm Chuck Reese, your host and the editor-in-chief of Salvation South, which you can find 24/7 at salvationsouth.com. The producer of this episode is also the director of podcasts at Georgia Public Broadcasting. His name is Jeremy Powell, and we thank him for his hard work and for making himself a valuable part of this conversation, too. And none of this could happen without the support of GPB's Sandy Malcolm and Bert Wesley Huffman. We will be back next month with another full-length episode of the Salvation South podcast.
So, well, maybe punk is dead. Maybe the hippies are through. And R&B and rockabilly have done all that they can do. And maybe the devil ain't still teaching the blues. And Nashville's been taken by these business suits. I'll just play it like I feel it. Let it come from my soul. 'Cause you don't need no teacher to rock and roll. I'll just play it like I feel it. Let it come from my soul. 'Cause you don't need no teacher to rock and roll.